10 minutes after 8 o'clock. Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Jack Andrea, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. The Vietnam War is on many people's minds right now, courtesy of the remarkable documentary film that is airing right now on PBS, and the series concludes next week. In light of that, both today and Monday on the Morning Show, I am replaying conversations I had with one of the most respected of war historians, Lewis Sorley. On today's program, I'll be playing in its entirety an interview which I played just a short sample of a few days ago. This is an interview about his biography of General Westmoreland. On Monday, you'll hear my conversation in its entirety with Mr. Sorley, our first conversation about his first comprehensive look at the Vietnam War, a book called A Better War. Before we get to today's interview, part one of today's Morning Show, we want to remind you of the phone number or website that you can visit if you would like to make a pledge of financial support to Wisconsin Public Radio. We are proud to be part of Wisconsin Public Radio, but we are as dependent on them as you can imagine in these days when journalism of the highest order is an expensive proposition for the ongoing well-being of public radio, and particularly Wisconsin Public Radio, and to help ensure that we can continue to bring you the very best in public radio broadcasting. I hope that you'll take a moment to express your appreciation for all that you hear over WGTD by calling or going online to be part of the Fall Pledge Drive. The phone number toll-free is 888-202-2552, 888-202-2552, or you can go to their website, wpr.org. And please indicate that you are a listener to WGTD and The Morning Show, and we thank you very much for your support. So here is part one of today's Morning Show at 13 minutes after 8 o'clock. Some of you may remember as vividly as I do an interview which I recorded with best-selling author Lewis Sorley about his much-discussed book called A Better War, which examined the final years of America's involvement in Vietnam and raised the very real and, of course, intriguing possibility that perhaps the way that conflict ended need not have ended as it had. A very, very carefully crafted and well-written book, and he follows it up now with a book that examines an earlier phase in America's involvement in Vietnam, specifically the involvement which was led by our own General William Westmoreland. The book is called Westmoreland, the General Who Lost Vietnam. And actually, the book is not so much limited to those years in which General Westmoreland led our forces in Vietnam, but is actually quite a comprehensive biography, sketching for us how he became the man that he was, and also talking in great detail about the years after Vietnam, when General Westmoreland sought, for the most part fruitlessly, to rehabilitate his image, so badly battered by the way things went in Vietnam under his command. The book is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and I'm very grateful to be able to have this opportunity to speak with Lewis Sorley, who actually served in Vietnam in the Pentagon in the offices of the Secretary of Defense and Army Chief of Staff. He has taught at West Point, an Army War College, and has written a number of superb books about military history. This book called Westmoreland, The General Who Lost Vietnam. Lewis Sorley, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you very much, sir. By the way, that was a wonderful capsule summary of the book.
Well, thank you for the compliment. And it's a book which I found very, very intriguing. Your prologue begins with this sentence. The premise of this study is that unless and until we understand William Child's Westmoreland, we will never understand fully what happened to us in Vietnam or why. Can you explain a little more about what is behind those words with which you begin your book?
Yes, and thanks for starting with that, because that's the key point, of course. General Westmoreland was a very conventional, even pedestrian officer. He did not get the benefit of the Army's great school system. Army officers, and probably other service officers too, get a wonderful regimen of repeated opportunities for higher education as they go through their careers. Westmoreland served for 36 years, and the only formal education he got was a one-month course in mess management offered by the Cooks and Bakers School in Hawaii when he was a lieutenant, and parachute school after World War II. He missed out on the Army on the Army's Command and General Staff College at Fort Leavenworth, did not attend the Army War College at Carlisle Barracks, and perversely was rather proud of that. He said he'd never read the book. When he got to Vietnam, he was faced with, as we now all know, an amazingly complex situation, one that would have challenged the best educated and most insightful commander. And frankly, he just wasn't up to it. But he stayed in command for 4 years, something we can explore if you wish. And during that 4 years, he hewed doggedly to the one approach to the conduct of the war he had begun with. He decided to fight a war of attrition. The way he fought that war was through large unit operations called search and destroy operations. The objective was to kill as many of the enemy as possible. Therefore, the measure of merit in such an approach to the war was body count. And Westmoreland was determined that if he could inflict enough casualties on the enemy, they would lose heart, give up, cease their aggression against the South, and go home again. But year after year, and asking for more and more U.S. forces, which for a long time he got, he continued to kill enemy in large numbers, but it didn't get him anywhere. The enemy just kept sending replacements down more and more. So how many he killed didn't seem to matter. Basically, he was on a treadmill. And until we understand that and his inability or unwillingness to even consider, much less adopt, a different approach to the war, it seems, you know, very difficult to understand what happened to us there.
Until I read your book, I was really mystified by what I had seen in a couple of different reviews which talked about your book and, of course, other accounts about General Westmoreland, painting this picture of a man of some gifts and showing some promise. I mean, a life that began well with some exciting successes and which seemed pointed towards ultimately a life of essentially complete success. And then, of course, comes Vietnam. And so, you know, just to kind of hear that, you wonder, well, did people misunderstand that great promise or what happened? And then at the end of your prologue, in a sense, you really spell out what ultimately we learn in the book. You write, Westmoreland's strengths eventually propelled him to a level beyond his understanding and abilities. That is, I mean, the fact that he was an Eagle Scout and all these other successes early in life, that does not mean that they prepared him to enjoy similar success when it came to as complicated a challenge as that which he faced in Vietnam.
I think that's exactly right. If General Westmoreland had retired, let us say, as a major general after commanding the 101st Airborne Division for 2 years, I think we would remember him as a very fine officer who did very well. It's only when he went to higher levels and more complicated situations that his limitations became so apparent. And I say near the end of the book something this effect, that I think we would view General Westmoreland with far more sympathy if it had not been for the fact that a principal reason he got to the levels he did was his unrelenting self-promotion, which was the reason why, primary reason why, let's say, that he got to the levels at which his at which he was in over his head.
Hmm. I appreciated how your book takes great care to explain some of the bedrock principles behind how he guided our efforts in Vietnam. And in fact, you devote an entire chapter to the matter of search and destroy. You've touched on this already. Could you say a word about why General Westmoreland believed this to be the best option? And in some respects, the best of a limited array of options in terms of how we should fight in Vietnam.
Yes, I would be glad to address that because it's key to why he didn't succeed. General Westmoreland, as I said, was a conventionally minded person. His World War II experience had been in one kind of war. He gets to Vietnam. It becomes apparent that if we're not going to let the South Vietnamese go down the drain in the early days, we're going to have to send some troops there to shore them up until they can become stronger. So we began to do that, and it, very early on, it becomes apparent that General Westmoreland decides, rather than shoring up the South Vietnamese, he's going to take these U.S. forces and win the war himself, hand the country back over to the South Vietnamese, and come home in glory. And so he bends all his efforts to that. There were two things among many, the two most outstanding things wrong with that approach. One, we've already discussed, it didn't matter how many of the enemy he killed, they just kept sending more, and so that didn't work. And secondly, the things that he ignored. He did not build up the South Vietnamese, far from it. They were left to fight with cast-off World War II U.S. weaponry during a time when the enemy, the communists, were being given the very best of equipment by their sponsors, the Soviet Union and Communist China, most notably the wonderful AK-47 assault rifle. And so the poor South Vietnamese not only ignored but outgunned for all of Westmoreland's time in command. The sweeps that he favored, the big unit operations, battalions, ganged one on another, or sometimes even divisions, took place mostly in the deep jungle, far from where the people were, and consequently didn't do a thing to help the people in the villages, and they were dominated by this communist covert infrastructure that was using terror and coercion to keep them under control. So not only was what he was doing in the jungles, killing enemy, not achieving the desired objective, but while he's out there doing that, the poor people in the rural South Vietnam are still under the enemy's domination. So either side of it you want to look at, it wasn't working. Now, it's important to know that General Westmoreland was offered a viable alternative. In Washington, General Harold K. Johnson, the Army Chief of Staff, the same 4 years Westmoreland was in Vietnam, cranked up a major study early on. It was known as PROVN, P-R-O-V-N. And that study examined what was being done in the situation and said, what Westmoreland is doing is not working, and it cannot work. And the main thing, reason why it couldn't work, was it was ignoring the war in the villages that we've talked about. So that was briefed to Westmoreland. Of course, he rejected it out of hand, and so he continued. And this is key. He was allowed to continue for 4 years with the approach that we've been discussing. But when he finally was replaced by General Creighton Abrams, who had been vice chief of staff when that study was done and had signed off on it when he took command in June of 1968 and stayed for 4 years, he adopted right away the PROVN approach and before long, things went much better. General Fred Wyand, who was a senior commander in Vietnam, corps-level commander at the time, said the tactics changed within 15 minutes of Abrams taking command. And instead of the search-and-destroy operations that Westmoreland had favored, now we had clear-and-hold operations sited much closer to the population so as to protect them and make the enemy come to you and fight on your terms instead of the other way around.
It's so interesting to hear about the concerns and reservations that many officers had about this whole notion of search and destroy. I mean, the name might be catchy, but as you've just outlined, it proved not to be effective. One of the people you quote is Brigadier General Ellis Williamson saying in "I hope that we have conducted our last search and destroy operation. I am thoroughly convinced that running into the jungle with a lot of people without a fixed target is a lot of effort, a lot of physical energy expended. A major portion of our effort evaporates into the air." I really appreciate the way he says that, because it helps us understand also the mounting sense of frustration and bewilderment that was the experience of so many of our soldiers on the ground in Vietnam involved in these search and destroy missions.
Yes, and poor General Williamson, he was a fine officer, and he went out in May of 1965. So this is at the very beginning of our introduction of ground forces with the 173rd Airborne Brigade, a top-notch outfit. And that quotation from him is spot on. He used to write what were called combat notes, and he'd issue them to his people in his unit, and sometimes he'd send them to other people, one of the other people being General Harold K. Johnson. And General Johnson hadn't gotten a combat notes from Williamson for a while, so he sent him a message. He said, if you've stopped sending the combat notes to me, start. If you've stopped writing them, start again. General Johnson found this right on, because the Proven study that he had conducted was completely congruent with what Williamson had seen on the ground. But that continued. Here's Williamson early on. In July of 65, we start sending divisions size units out there, and eventually we build up to where we've got corps level headquarters as well. There's a vignette. I'll try to shorten it because I know your time is limited. But then Lieutenant General Fred Wyand commanded a field force, corps level headquarters, later, a couple of years later, and he's approached by two reporters, and he talks very candidly to them off the record, and he says, "I've beat up the same Viet Cong division three times now, and they just go back over the borders. You know, we allowed sanctuaries across the borders into Laos and Cambodia, and they refit and come back in. Then I have to do the same thing to them over again." He says, "We're not getting anywhere." R.W. Apple, the famous Johnny Apple, wrote a great piece on this for the New York Times, and he said, "This is a stalemate." This is in '67. Westmoreland's been there 3 years now, a stalemate. And in Washington, they went ballistic. The president and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Wheeler, sent a message out to Westmoreland and said, "My God, what's this all about?" Westmoreland said confidently, "No general of mine would ever say that." But one of his generals had, and not till much later did that general allow himself to be identified, not until after Westmoreland had passed from this life. But then they were able to say, "This was General Fred Wyand," and Wyand was a wonderfully fine officer and full of credibility, and he was exactly right. Mm-hmm.
Another chapter of your book deals with the matter of body count and the fact that if this was all about the numbers, this war of attrition, then the numbers really counted. And the trouble was, of course, the ultimate distortion of numbers, that in a sense the numbers should have told us if we were succeeding or failing, but the numbers also were important for the sense of our commitment in Vietnam and what discouraging numbers would do to our commitment. I mean, in many respects, that's as crucial as anything, the fact that these numbers meant two different things, and when you began to distort the numbers, you were distorting everything.
That is exactly right, and there were at least two major things wrong with body count as a measure of merit. One we've already touched on. It didn't really matter how many the enemy killed because their willingness to send replacements was unlimited. Someone, I think, David Halberstam maybe once wrote that we were fighting the birth rate of a nation, and so that wasn't going to achieve the objectives that General Westmoreland thought it would. The other part of it, which you allude to, is the body count was I don't see any other way to say this, a corrupt and corrupting influence on our own chain of command. There was enormous pressure, especially in certain headquarters, to report high body counts, so inevitably some became inflated. And so then, even if it had been a viable measure of merit, it was no longer reliable. And a wonderful man, Ambassador Ellsworth Bunker, came on the scene in March of 67 and served for 6 years as head of our embassy there. And one of his most basic conclusions was body count is not a good measure of progress in a war like this.
This is tied up in something which came to be known as the Progress Offensive. It was really a PR campaign back home engineered by the Johnson administration. And I suppose at the time, caught in this difficult situation, it must have made some kind of sense. But we read about it now, and it's so disturbing. I mean, on all kinds of different levels. That so much of this effort at this point in time became about PR.
Yes, it was, and General Westmoreland lent himself to that effort with great enthusiasm. He claimed then and later in his memoirs that he was an unwilling participant, but all of his senior associates said no. He really liked to be in the spotlight. He really liked to be dealing at the higher levels. He'd come back to Vietnam after one of those trips to the United States, just buoyed up and on cloud nine, said his associate General Bruce Palmer. So the problem here was, okay, he's going back to the United States three times during 1967. No commander of a major expeditionary force before that had ever done that. Peter Braestrup said Westmoreland took the king's shilling and it cost him his reputation. He went to the AP editor's luncheon. He went on Meet the Press. He went to the National Press Club. He spoke to a joint session of Congress, and he said things like, I've never been more encouraged during my almost 4 years in Vietnam, and things like, we've reached the point where the end is beginning to come into sight, and things like the enemy's hopes are bankrupt. And his last appearance was in November. In January, the enemy launches its Tet Offensive of 1968, and people see this on their television sets, and a lot of them conclude that either General Westmoreland hadn't known what he was talking about, all those things he said when he was back in the States, or he hadn't leveled with the American people. And it's hard for me to say which is the more devastating criticism.
You quote Army historian Jeffrey Clark as talking about the cult of optimism fostered in Saigon and Washington, which was self-defeating and in the end only encouraged the continuation of policies and practices that had little hope of success. One of the most disturbing moments in the book, I think, is about a relatively minor matter, and yet it points to General Westmoreland's hunger to be respected and admired and to win this sort of PR campaign. It's something which occurred in 1967 or 68 in which some sort of media event was concocted in which he would hand out some Silver Star awards, supposedly, to some soldiers. Can you finish the story for our listeners?
I can, but it's a very sad story. And it's told by a soldier who was there at the time, so I believe it to be absolutely authentic. Westmoreland shows up with an entourage. He always traveled with a lot of people, and in a helicopter, and trailing him is another helicopter full of press, photographers, and reporters. And they land at this battalion location. The battalion has been told to expect them and to prepare for a Silver Star Award ceremony. They can't understand this because they have no pending recommendations for Silver Stars, but they line up the requisite number of soldiers. Westmoreland gets off the helicopter. He's got one arm in a sling from a tennis injury, as they later find out, but said, one, this didn't keep him from having an imperious air. As he goes down the line and pins these silver stars on uncomprehending soldiers, and then gets back in his helicopter and flies away. And after he leaves, the battalion executive officer goes down the line and takes back the silver stars, an award ceremony in reverse, as they called it. And the officer who told the story said, we were just props in his public relations campaign.
The public relations campaign of General Westmoreland seems to have, if anything, become more intense and all-consuming once he left Vietnam, first to become Army Chief of Staff and ultimately in retirement as well. He did so much to try to rehabilitate his image and to paint what he had done in Vietnam in more positive light. One of the most interesting parts of your book in dealing with post-Vietnam for General Westmoreland involves the controversy around a documentary which CBS did with him. Could you just say a quick word about this? This is one of the most interesting things in the book.
It is, and it's one of the saddest, too, because, well, to begin with, CBS aired a documentary which General Westmoreland had participated in the making of. He allowed himself to be interviewed on camera at length. And so then this documentary says in its most important charge that he had manipulated enemy strength figures to make it look like that more progress was being made than really was. And so Westmoreland decides to sue CBS, and he asked for $120 million in damage. He had been warned by very powerful, high-powered lawyers who had his best interests at heart, people like Stanley Rezor, who had been Secretary of the Army, and Cyrus Vance, who had been Deputy Secretary of Defense. Don't do this. The bar for public figures is too high. You can't win. But he ignored that. He sued CBS, who got David Boies, probably the best lawyer in America, as their lead attorney. Westmoreland couldn't find any well-known attorney who would take his case for the reasons the others had told him about. He gets Dan Burt, a man who had never tried a case in court. They go to trial in the Southern District of New York in Manhattan. 18 weeks the trial goes on, and only days before the thing is going to the jury, Westmoreland withdraws his suit in exchange for a very vanilla statement from CBS. And then he says, and I took it home, all flags flying. Well, the editorial responses were devastating. They said he had been foolish to start this suit in the first place, that it was obvious that he was going to lose, and that he only bailed out for that reason. Some people said, this is a little footnote to this, some people said that the reason he wanted to do this was to get back on the front page, or at least the second page of the newspapers. And another take on that same thing is they gave him another chance to argue his case for his performance in Vietnam. Hmm. If so, it was a very ill-advised and it had a very unsatisfying outcome for him.
Another example of what you call the infinitely sad story of General Westmoreland. One of his admirers is quoted at some point in your book as saying, "I am absolutely convinced that Westmoreland did not understand the war, does not understand it now, but everything he did because he thought it was the right thing to do." We can learn much more about this fascinating man and his ultimately tragic story in this carefully researched book, complete with bibliography and footnotes. The book is Westmoreland, the General Who Lost Vietnam, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Lewis Sorley, thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about your fascinating and troubling book.
Thank you, sir. It's been my pleasure.
You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. And a reminder that on Monday's morning show, I will be replaying my conversation with Lewis Sorley about an earlier book, which looks actually more comprehensively at the Vietnam War, and in particular, the way in which our American war effort ended. That's on Monday's morning show, just after 8 o'clock. Here's part two of today's program.
And just when you think that every fascinating story of the Second World War has already been told, here comes yet another fascinating but largely untold story. It's in a book called 12 Desperate Miles, the epic World War II voyage of the SS Contessa. This is a story which hooks into actually a monumentally important undertaking in the Second World War, Operation Torch, which was the Allies' first big move against the Axis powers, invading certain important ports in northern Africa. And anyone who knows, for instance, the story of General Patton knows something about Operation Torch. But within that great military undertaking is this smaller story, this essential story of a particular boat, the SS Contessa, which is just one of a number of vessels that were involved in this gigantic undertaking. But the circumstances under which this particular boat was a participant are particularly interesting. The story told in this book by author Tim Brady, who is a veteran history writer and writes frequently for, among others, the History Channel. And this book is published by Crown, again called 12 Desperate Miles. And Tim Brady, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks very much for having me.
I look forward to talking with you a little more about this really fascinating story. Obviously, as someone who knows history as well as you do, you knew something about Operation Torch before you even began writing this book. But this book obviously had a focus on a sort of a smaller story within that larger story. How did you ever even find out about the SS Contessa?
Well, I was reading a bigger history of the invasion of North Africa, Rick Atkinson's book on that subject, and I saw in his book this little anecdote. And since I do a lot of magazine writing, history magazine writing, I just sort of made note of it and thought it would be a good magazine story. The more I dug into it, however, the bigger it got, and it turned into this book.
So tell us, first of all, a little bit about Operation Torch. I mean, very briefly, why the Allied effort against the Axis began with this kind of operation. What was the hope of what would be accomplished?
Well, there was much question in 1942 about how the U.S. would enter the World War II. The initial American idea was to attack the Axis powers directly from England across the English Channel, the attack that ultimately became D-Day. The British were strongly opposed to this. They thought it would be suicidal. It would wreck the Allies before they even got going. So the alternatives were considered, and one was to attack North Africa, to invade North Africa.
And the idea, of course, was not only that this is not a direct assault on Nazi Germany itself, but it's sort of attacking, in a sense, its flank, rear flank, maybe. But your book tells us that part of the hope was that in this sort of attack, it would force Nazi Germany to sort of swing its attention elsewhere, and maybe in such a way that Europe itself would sort of be a different playing field than it was before Operation Torch was undertaken. Am I remembering that correctly?
Exactly. And the greatest consideration at the moment was the extreme pressure that the Soviet Union was under at the time, and the, through by Germany. They were being
assaulted at Stalingrad, and Stalin needed relief from these Nazi pressures, and the Allies thought that they could both relieve those pressures on the Eastern Front and have a less challenging assault on the Axis powers in North Africa. Now, I don't mean to belittle what happened in North Africa at all, but just to say that rather than attacking the Nazis frontally across the English Channel, the attack in North Africa, the first forces they would face were the were French forces defending the Vichy French interests in North Africa.
We're ultimately talking in this undertaking about hundreds of ships and many thousands of troops heading to North Africa from both America and Britain. Mm-hmm. And in amongst them is this very unlikely ship that ends up being part of this monumental project, namely this SS Contessa, which is in effect a humble little banana boat. How is it that a ship like that would end up being even a small part of an operation like this, let alone an ultimately important part of Operation Torch?
You know, that was the very question that animated my interest in this book, in doing this book from the beginning. The fact of the matter is that in the course of planning the invasion of North Africa, George Patton decided that there was an airport in Morocco that would be crucial to his plans to invade Casablanca. And so he determined that airport needed to be taken, and that airport also needed to be supplied with gasoline and munitions, so that he could use the airport as a base for his assault on Casablanca. Now, the port was 12 miles up a very shallow river in Morocco, and at the start of the planning for the invasion, it was determined that Patton decided that he had to get a ship up that river to supply the airport. There was one ship that the Navy and other forces in the operations could find in the Atlantic that could make that journey, and it was this banana boat, the Contessa.
One of the ways in which we sort of appreciate the unlikelihood, the almost the absurdity of this rusty old vessel being part of all this is the picture that you paint right at the start of chapter one of your book, in which you say something to the effect that one of the most important sort of almost like battle lines or battlefields of the Second World War, although nobody exactly saw it that way at the time, was the harbor of New York City. Mm-hmm. And the array of vessels that were there. And in other places along the American eastern seaboard that were sort of gathering strength for some sort of strike against the Axis. But you sort of paint this picture of this impressive armada growing more impressive by the day, but also the very real threat of German submarines very, very close off of our east coast. A very tangible threat to our military well-being. It's a really interesting question, picture you paint there, and it helps us understand the odd role that the SS Contessa plays in that.
Yeah, and I think it's a picture that people have forgotten through the years, because you know, the story of World War II is such a huge story, and what was to come in 1942, ultimately, sort of put the early picture of the war in the background. But what we should remember that the war on Europe didn't really begin until almost a year after Pearl Harbor. And for that first year of the war, the United States itself was under attack through these U-boat assaults that were happening really on a daily basis, almost on the eastern seaboard. Hundreds of ships were lost to the German submarine attacks, and so you have to get a portrait of the eastern seaboard as the war is beginning, and the preparations for the war involve moving ships here and there, transporting troops to England and transporting supplies to the Soviet Union, and there's a lot of activity on the eastern seaboard, but it's there's at the same time there's this assault being undertaken by German forces. So it's a frightening time for people living along the coast.
Absolutely. So there is this plan then conceived, and all of these ships moving across the Atlantic, and rather hurriedly, when it's discovered that a very sort of special kind of vessel is going to be needed for this particular operation involving this 12-mile stretch of river, which would take the Allies to this really crucial air base, that the SS Contessa is rather hurriedly added to the mix. Where was the Contessa at this time, and where was its crew?
Well, the Contessa, at the start of the organization of the convoy to go to North Africa, was not a part of that operation. It was transporting troops from New York, American troops from New York to Ireland and Britain, England. And so it had been making runs back and forth between New York and Northern Ireland and England and back to New York. So that's where it was when it was determined that this was the only ship. And I should add that it was the because it was a banana boat, it carried cargo from South and Central America, fruit and bananas from South and Central America to New Orleans. That was what its original intent was. It had a very shallow draft, and it could go up these South American rivers to plantations to pick up cargo. That was what made it essential, ideal for the trip up the river in Morocco. At any rate, it was during the war, it was making these transport runs. And then it was discovered by Patton and company, and was called to Norfolk, Virginia, to get ready for this convoy trip across the Atlantic to Morocco and up the river. When it arrived in Norfolk, it was late for the operation. It was called in at the last minute. When the ship pulled into the Hampton Roads Harbor in Norfolk, the captain of the ship dismissed his crew. He thought that he wasn't certain what was next. He'd just gotten an order to sail to Norfolk. He let his crew go. They went off to have fun in the wilds of Norfolk, and and soon thereafter the powers that be in the convoy came to the captain and said, "You need to sail immediately to North Africa." And he was missing half of his crew.
Hmm. So you're one of the things your book tells us is about sort of the scramble to get this ship, the Contessa, staffed. And
yes.
They even turned to the local jail for at least some of the crew that ended up making the trip, correct?
That is correct. Norfolk at the time was a pretty wild, pretty wild town. It was it had for 100 years it had been a East Coast seaport, so it had that tradition of a lot of seamen getting out and carousing after long voyages. to add to that, during the war, it was just filled with thousands and thousands of soldiers who were getting ready to ship out. The bar scene in Norfolk was thick, and so you can imagine the crew gets out, they head out to the streets of Norfolk, and now the captain finds out he has to sail to North Africa. There was no one to be found, so they went to the Norfolk County Jail and wound up getting 18 seamen who had spent the weekend carousing and were tossed into the brig and now had to sober up and immediately sail off to North Africa.
And of course, they end up missing the protection of the convoy for at least a large part of the trip. One of the things your book has is a map which shows the main body of this naval force making the trip. And then here's, I think, this little dotted line which depicts the route of the SS Contessa. And for the majority of the trip, it's on its own crossing the Atlantic Ocean. I mean, that in and of itself is an amazing story.
It was really quite frightening. The convoy is 100 ships, and they've sailed 2 days before the Contessa finally gets out of port. So the Contessa is essentially 2 days behind the convoy. And, you know, a 100-ship convoy leaves a pretty large mark on the ocean as it sails. So that's, you know, the U-boats who were out hunting anything that moved on the Atlantic would certainly, you would think, the chances were very good that they would come upon this 100-ship convoy at some time. Hmm. And the way the U-boats hunted was, you know, like they were called wolf packs for a reason. They liked to hunt for the strays that fell out of the convoy, so a ship sailing behind the convoy was really fair game.
Mm. So, of course, the heart and soul of your book is not only this trip across the Atlantic, but once it does reach Africa, then it is the story of this 12-mile route up this river to take it to this important airfield. And that story in and of itself, and of the Frenchman who helped lead the Contessa, this man who knew that river intimately, is much of what your book focuses upon, and it reads like a great, great thriller. I do want to take a moment to ask you about something else that I think is an important backdrop to the story, namely the strange tensions that were in the air with the people that lived in this part of the world, in Tunisia and Morocco and so on. I mean, in terms of sort of divided, split loyalties.
Yeah.
That's an interesting story in and of itself. Maybe not the stuff that Hollywood epics are made of, but a very, very important part of this story.
Yeah, it was strange times in Morocco. There were really, as you say, divided loyalties. A great number of the citizens of French Morocco were like the person, the river pilot you mentioned, René Malvern, were people who were free French enthusiasts. They despised the Vichy government. They despised the collaboration with the Nazis. But at the same time, you know, there were people who remained loyal to Vichy France, and in fact, those were the people who were running the government of Morocco at the time, and the rest of French North Africa. So there was this real dichotomy of interests, and you know, if you think of the movie Casablanca, that depicts that sort of it depicts the sort of divided loyalties of the French in Morocco at the time, and that is true in this book as well. So it, you know, there were a lot of complications involved, to put it mildly.
I'm so glad that your book thoughtfully explores all of that and more. The book again is called 12 Desperate Miles: The Epic World War II Voyage of the SS Contessa. It's published by Crown. It includes photographs and maps that help us follow this story even more closely and clearly. The author, Tim Brady. Tim Brady, congratulations on a very, very